Hi, guys. It is a hot, sticky, 80-something degree, miserable November day here in Garfield, Texas, here in the collapse of global industrial civilization. But we're going to cool off a little bit and head to, I believe, Crescent City, California, this afternoon, where I have the long overdue pleasure. I cannot believe that Collapse Chronicles is a year and a half old, and this is the first time that we have had on the show the one and only Derek Jensen. Anybody on Collapse Chronicles not knowing who Derek Jensen is, I will just give you a very brief introduction. Derek Jensen is an American author, eco-philosopher, and radical environmentalist, which we're going to talk a lot about. According to Democracy Now!, Derek has been called the poet philosopher of the ecological movement. Jensen has published, good Lord, I think at least 20 books, including the number one, what I put is perhaps the number one best book, well, it's a two-volume set called Endgame, that question and critique civilization as an entire social system, exploring what he describes as its inherent values, hidden premises, and modern links to supremacism, oppression, and genocide, as well as corporate, domestic, and worldwide ecological abuse. Okay, with all of that, Derek Jensen, would you please come on and say hello to the folks at Collapse Chronicles, and we're going to dive right into this.
Well, hi, and thank you for having me on the program.
Okay, so as I've been emailing Derek, just, you know, one of the reasons it's taken me so long to talk to you, brother, is just trying to come up with questions that you have not been asked by 10,000 other interviewers. And here's one I have to admit right here off the first line in about Derek Jensen. I have often wondered about this. What were you ever doing getting a Bachelor's of Science degree in mineral engineering physics from the Colorado School of Mines back in 1983?
Well, when I was in high school, I was pretty good at math, and so if you're pretty good at math when you're in high school, when you're 18, 17, however old I was, and you don't really have the money to go to college, and then you get a scholarship to one of the best engineering schools in the world, and you do it because that's going to be your life. You're going to, I mean, I was at the School of Mines after the start of my second year. I was so unhappy that I went to the registrar at the University of Colorado to think about transferring. And I went to the registrar's office and said, hi, I'm at the School of Mines. And, you know, I've got a scholarship down there, but I'm thinking of transferring to CU. And she said, this is a direct quote, you are on a scholarship to the School of Mines. You want to transfer to the University of Colorado and pay for it yourself? Are you crazy? And, excuse me, the point is that in terms of staying within the culture, going to the School of Mines pretty much guarantees you an extremely well-paying job, a very comfortable income for the rest of your life, working for oil companies, working for, whatever you end up working in, you're going to be an engineer for some sort of company. And then the mineral engineering physics is, I got a regular physics degree, but everybody at the Colorado School of Mines has to take a year and a half of geology just in addition. And so there's the mineral. And then they also have to take a whole bunch of engineering classes. So there's the engineering. So it was a regular physics degree with some geology and a whole bunch of engineering thrown on top. And when I was at the School of Mines, I was, most of the people at the School of Mines hated it. And we all recognized it as a four-year boot camp. And that's one reason that people, when they get out of the School of Mines, they they get good jobs is because people know that they can work and they know they have a good work ethic. And that doesn't alter the fact that when I was there, I was not very happy. And when I would ask other students if they were very happy, they say no. But when I get out of here, I'm going to buy myself a really nice car. And it just was occurring to me more and more that I just didn't want to do engineering as a life. And I mean, it's like the old Bachman Turner Overdrive song from the 70s. You get up every morning from your alarm clock's warning, take the 8:15 to the city, and there's a whistle up above and people pushing, people shoving, all the girls are trying to look pretty. Well, if your train's on time, you can get to work by 9 and start your slaving job and get your pay. But if you ever get annoyed, look at me, I'm self-employed. I love to work at nothing all day. And not to put too fine a point on it, but that sounded pretty good to me. So the point I'm getting at is I started questioning the wage economy. I started questioning, I would ask people, do you like your jobs? Like if I got in a taxi, if I got on a bus, if I was at the grocery store, I would just ask random people. And about 90% said no. And I started wondering, so what does it mean when the vast majority of people spend the vast majority of their waking hours doing things they don't want to do? Why do you have a system like that? And so, you know, at the same time, if we go back a little bit to my junior high days and elementary school days, I wanted to be a writer. But then I put that away because, you know, if you can go to the School of Mines on a scholarship, then you're crazy not to. But then when I got out, I realized, I talked to my mom when I was a junior and said, I want to quit. And she said something very, very smart, which is, do you want to go the rest of your life saying you have a degree in physics, or do you want to go the rest of your life saying you have 3 years toward a degree in physics? And that made a lot of sense to me. But then I finished the degree, and then she also said something that was very smart to me, which is, I said, look, I don't want to stay in physics. And she said, well, that's okay. I said, but isn't that a waste of 4 years? And she said, well, better you waste 4 years than waste your life. And so I just set out to do what I wanted to do. And first I became a beekeeper. I love keeping bees, but the real point was that you work really, really hard at some times of the year, and other times of the year I could take time off and learn how to write, because writing, like anything, is a really long apprenticeship. And so there's the version of how I went to the School of Mines.
Okay, so any regrets as an almost 60-year-old looking back? Are you glad you made the decision to get out of mining physics and into writing?
Yes, I am, and I'm not going to – this is kind of glib, but I am, except when I consider the fact that had I gone straight into physics, I could have retired a long time ago, and I would now be getting an income for sitting around doing what I'm doing. But no, I wouldn't trade. That is really glib, that I would not trade. I mean, there are regrets I have in my life, but this is not one of them. I wouldn't trade the life I've had for a different one. And, you know, I was thinking about this because my, excuse me, my mom died a year ago, tonight.
Oh, I'm sorry.
And, that has sent me into a year of mourning and being gutted, frankly, and also, thinking a lot about mortality. And one of the questions I was asking myself as I was walking through the forest the other day is, if I knew that my life was going to turn out exactly as it did, would I live it again on death? It's like, you know, basically, if it's marginal cost, marginal return, has my life been more fun than not? And I would do this life again. I would certainly do this life again. And I can see there are certainly some lives. I mean, like if I could only live certain parts of my life and they were the bad parts, I would say, no, I don't want to do that again. But if you take the whole thing as a whole, yeah, absolutely, I would want to do this again.
But you spend a lot of your time, Derek, as any of us do down here in the in this rabbit hole. You spend a lot of time of your life investigating some pretty brutal aspects of living in planet Earth now in the 21st century. Would you do that again?
Yeah, I would. I think at one point, Daniel Quinn said something about me. So my publisher for A Language Older Than Words and Culture Make-Believe was pretty good friends with Daniel Quinn. And I never spoke with Daniel Quinn, but I was pretty good friends with that publisher. So, you know, we would chat. I would chat with Bo, that publisher, a lot, and Bo would chat with Daniel Quinn a lot. So at one point, Daniel Quinn said something about how I have constitutionally or whatever the capacity to stare at some of these horrors without them devastating me. It's like I can look at them and take them in and metabolize them and then turn them into something, a gift for the community through the work. And that's true on a lot of things. This is not entirely true in that there are some things that I wish I could unsee that I have seen in the research that I do. Some things are fine. You know, I can remember when I was writing Culture Make-Believe, I would be – and by the way, this interview is going differently than pretty much every interview I've ever done. So you are
asking questions. Well, I'm getting ready to go, I do not want to interview the thought processes of Derek Jensen, but I would like to put you to the test.
Hold on. Okay. I want to finish this story first.
All right.
That was just an aside, and then I'll come back. So I can remember when I was doing research for Culture Make-Believe, just sitting in, I remember specifically the chapter or a section on child labor, and I'm just sitting in, I lived in Spokane when I wrote some of that, and I'm sitting in the Gonzaga Library in the stacks in their section on child labor, just sobbing as I'm reading this horrible material about what children were doing in coal mines. And at the same time that I'm sobbing, there's another part of me inside going, I know exactly where this fits in the book. And so there's that sort of split that happens a lot where I'll see something and it can make me burst. I burst into sobs not infrequently when I'm doing research. There was a time I was doing research on a book that's not out yet where I was encountered this just dreadful stuff. And even though it was 1 o'clock in the morning, I called a friend who fortunately had caller ID and they knew it was me and not some weirdo because I couldn't even speak for like the first 30 seconds. I was just like hyperventilating because the stuff I was reading was so disturbing. And that said, there are things, there are images I wish I had never seen. And I'm not going to describe it because it's too horrific, but there was a documentary on HBO back in 2000 or something about how humans treat non-humans. And there was much of it I could take in, but there are a couple scenes that made me go, I wish I had not seen this documentary. But the thing that keeps me going through all of this is the understanding that I can turn off that documentary. I can put the book down, and the beings who are living this, they can't put it down. That is their actual reality. And that's one of the things that keeps me going through this. It's like, you know, if I want to feel like, oh, poor me, I have to read all this material, that's nonsense. The truth is the ones who are really in trouble are the ones who have to live that reality. And if they can live that reality, the least I can do is bear witness to it.
Okay. Well, I am bearing witness to one of the most horrific images I have seen in the year 2019. So, here's a question I think you have never been asked before in your entire life. And see if Derek, this is a real test. Does Derek Jensen know the answer? Derek Jensen, what is the number one cause of death of Sri Lankan elephants for the past 2 years running?
Do you want me to make some guesses?
It's not being run over by trains like I thought it would be. So have I actually stopped Derek Jensen?
Okay. If this were 20 years ago, I would say war. Oh, you know what I'm going to guess? I could be wrong, but this is my guess, is landmines.
You're pretty, you're on the right track, but here is the The answer, explosive devices concealed in bait for bushmeat have overtaken gunshot injuries as the primary cause of elephant deaths in Sri Lanka since last year. These devices, known as jaw exploders, are aimed primarily at wild boar, but are increasingly maiming and killing elephants. The explosives cause horrific injuries, shattering the elephant's jaw and destroying soft tissue inside the mouth, leading ultimately to a slow and painful death from infection.
I get pretty tired of us.
I probably read 10,000 stories like this year, Derek, and there's something about this story, and of course the attendant photographs, that at some point, I get pretty tired of us. I mean, what do you do when you heard that for the first time in your life? You haven't even seen the pictures, brother. What do you make of that? What do you, when you encounter something like this, what do you do with your grief and your rage about this situation you have no control over?
I use it. You know, I have never forgotten something that someone said to me at a conference. I did some sort of presentation at a conference all the way back in the, like, 96 or 97 or somewhere in there. I did a 5-minute presentation at this thing. And afterwards, this woman came up to me who was a anti-pesticide activist in Minnesota where the thing took place. And one of the things she said to me I've never forgotten, which is, sometimes the only things that keep me going are rage and sorrow. And I use that to fuel my work. And I use that to fuel my determination to bring down this culture before it kills everything on the planet. And it stiffens my resolve. It is, you know, my loyalty is to the natural world, and my loyalty is not to the dominant culture, and is not to human beings particularly. It is to those remaining indigenous human beings who are living in with the land, but that's not really the point here, because if they're using explosive devices, they're not living traditional indigenous ways. And so when I hear about something like that, it is not dissimilar to someone hearing about atrocities committed by one's enemy in a time of war, because the dominant culture has long since declared war on the natural world. And I mean, for God's sake, if using explosives to blow off the mouths of elephants does not count as an act of war, what precisely would it take for someone to call it an act of war? I mean, these are explosives, for God's sake. And so what I do with information like this is two things. One is, three things, multiple things. One is, it makes me really sad. Two, it makes me really angry. If I were to look at those photographs, I would probably start crying. And then there would be a part of my brain where, just like with the child labor, I would file that away. And that's some ammunition to use at the right place in the right book. And so that's how I respond. That's how I respond to it. I'm not one of those people who responds by hearing difficult information, hearing of atrocities, and them making me want to cower and curl up under the pillows. I mean, curl up under the covers. There are things that can do that to me. I'm not saying I'm some sort of superhuman person. I mean, frankly, my mom's death, and that has caused me to want to go under my, you know, covers and pull them up and pretend that none of this ever happened. That's But the atrocities of the culture, they just make me want to get up and keep swinging.
Yeah. Okay. That leads me into this. I got this comment a couple of months ago. I can't remember the actual whatever it was that I said, but I made some point about humans committing violence against nature, and I got a comment from one of my subscribers who is also a fan of yours. They left a long comment on an essay you wrote yesterday, so I know this fellow is a fan of yours. I don't have the exact comment, but the gist of it, he was calling me out saying you cannot commit violence against nature. You can only commit violence against other humans. And I have to admit my jaw dropped and I'm thinking I have really had a failure to communicate. So this person is a fan of yours. I won't use any names here. So what would you say to anyone telling you you cannot commit violence against nature?
I thought that went a slightly different direction than I thought it was going to be taken. That I thought they were going to say you can't commit violence against nature because nature is an overarching category, and so you can commit nature against this bear or that tree, but what is the larger category, nature? And that would be a different discussion to have, but that's not obviously the direction you went.
Well, maybe that's where they were coming from, and I just misinterpreted it. So,
well, I don't know, obviously, but that I'm not even sure I agree with that, because we can talk about the capital H Holocaust. In fact, it's interesting. I mean, probably one of the reasons my mind went that direction is because right now, not right now, but last night and then tonight, I'm writing a preface for the French edition of Julia Butterfly Hill's book, The Legacy of Luna. And, you know, she sat in a tree.
Yeah.
And I'm starting this preface by saying, and to protect the tree, she was a tree sitter. And I'm starting the preface by saying, you know, the problems we face are really overwhelming and they're really daunting. And it's really easy to just sit down and I mean, this culture is killing the planet. And so we can just go, oh my gosh, there's nothing I can do. It's just too big. But at the same time, we have to recognize that, while it's true that this culture is killing the planet, any mass atrocity consists of a myriad of small atrocities. And then I talk about the Capital H Holocaust, you know, the Germans killing the Jews and the communists and homosexuals. And I say, yes, there is a Capital H Holocaust that harmed the larger community. And there is also what it consisted of is literally millions of murders. And so there is this person and this person and this person. And then when you look at it that way, then I move into what Julia Butterfly Hill did in terms of saving one tree. Because, you know, we have to save entire forests, but she got off her butt and did something. She saved one tree, which is stopping one atrocity. It's like Schindler, you know, with Schindler's List. He didn't stop the Holocaust, but he certainly saved some individuals. And that's great. That's really important. So anyway, that's the direction we can go with that one. If we go the other direction, you know, when I wrote Endgame, one of the reasons I wanted to do it is because there's a lot of really sloppy thinking about the word violence. And people will say, for example, I had this discussion with somebody one time where she said, all violence is bad. And I said, do you defecate? And she said, why? Yeah, why? And I said, because every time you defecate, you're killing billions of bacteria who were very happy in your guts, and now they're going to be in a place that they could have been, you know, anaerobic, and now they're going to be in an aerobic situation. They're going to die. So that's killing them. And he's like, yeah, that's silly. I said, no, here's the point, is that what is your definition of violence? And clearly the person who wrote in, if we go the second direction, the person who wrote in, their definition of violence is any act that harms a human, maybe. My definition of violence, and I just want to be clear, because it's really important to clarify terms. My definition of violence is any act that does harm to another. And I love this definition because it shows it normalizes violence, by which I don't mean it makes it okay to go punch your neighbor. I'm not saying that at all. What I'm saying is that You know, if every time I eat, last night I had some shrimp and those shrimp died. Those shrimp, somebody committed an act of violence for me so I could eat those. And it doesn't matter. If I'm eating potatoes, an act of violence was done against those potatoes. And here's the thing is that most of us, under most circumstances, would consider it acceptable to do an act of violence to a carrot. You're killing that carrot whose life is as important to that carrot as yours is to you and mine is to me. But most of us under most circumstances, myself included, would consider it perfectly acceptable to pull a carrot out and eat it. On the other hand, most of us under most circumstances would not consider it acceptable to kill a human being. And there are some circumstances where we might. Some people may not. I would certainly find it okay for someone, I don't care who, to kill Ted Bundy or to kill Adolf Hitler, to choose a couple easy examples. But what I think is really, really important and what I think we desperately need is a conversation both personally and socially about what forms of violence we do and do not find acceptable. Again, we find it acceptable to do an act of violence to a carrot. We generally don't find it acceptable to do an act of violence. Okay, I think we would all not find it acceptable to do an act of violence to a 1.5-year-old baby who is sleeping peacefully in a crib and has never done any harm to anybody. I think we would all agree.
I think everyone listening to this could agree with that.
Yeah. So then the discussion is, where do we communally and socially, because obviously this culture finds it okay to deforest the planet. That act of violence is okay. This culture finds it okay to make it so most rivers no longer reach the ocean. That form of violence is okay. This culture finds it okay to drive the vaquitas extinct. It finds that okay. Those are unacceptable forms of violence to me. And this culture finds it, I mean, we can just go through. So what I really wanted to do, it really bugs me that sometimes people would call me, oh, Derek's the violence guy because he advocates violence. It's like, no, that's not true. What I advocate is having an open and honest discussion about what we personally and socially consider to be acceptable and not acceptable forms of violence. I mean, obviously, for those in power, they find it, quote, regrettable, but also acceptable to drop bombs from drones onto other countries. That's morally acceptable to them. Okay, I can accept that it's morally acceptable to them, but I want to have that discussion across society about whether we all find it morally acceptable. So that's the discussion I really want to spark when we talk about violence, is I want to spark exactly the discussion that was had. That person doesn't consider it, let's presume, that person doesn't consider it violence to chop down a tree or to shoot a bear. That's fine. I do consider those acts of violence, and let's talk about why and how that person doesn't consider them acts of violence and why I do. I get some crap sometimes. I don't really want to go into this. I don't even know why I'm bringing it up, but here we go. But
just go for it, Derek. Bring it up.
I get some flack sometimes because I don't theoretically object to the death penalty. And I recognize that it is classist and racist. So yes, I have that problem with it. But honestly, there are so many people on death row. I read a lot of these accounts. And it's like, I'm sorry, you know, if you strangle your wife and then shoot her two children and then your child, I'm sorry. I mean, there are things people can do that can forfeit the right to live. And my point is, that's a form of violence that under some circumstances I find acceptable and other people don't. And that's okay. That's a discussion I want to have in public. That's the whole point.
You know how much trouble this is going to get you in, and if I say I agree with you, amen, brother, 100%, we might as well go down together, Derek. I have gotten more flack on my saying we need more capital punishment on this planet, not less. That comment has gotten me in more trouble than any other thing I have ever said. But we're going to move on.
Before we move on, I want to put myself in a little bit deeper. Is that I got in some trouble. This was with right wingers instead of left wingers. I got in some trouble for saying that after the Deepwater Horizon spill,
yeah,
that Tony Hayward should be put on trial for murder of those workers in the Gulf and also murder of the Gulf. And if found guilty, he should be executed. And I got a lot of crap for that one. But so, yeah, that's I mean, he's a white rich guy. And I think that his punishment for what he did should have been imprisonment and execution if found guilty, instead of getting a $36 million severance package.
Is he still alive? Did he die? I think that man might have left us. Anyway, we're going to switch. We are exactly one half of the way through this, and I'm about one-tenth of the way through my notes. Derek Jensen, are you or are you not an environmentalist?
Sure, if that means somebody who cares about the natural world. My loyalty is to the natural world. I don't, and before anybody freaks out at that, we have to, the natural world is the source of all life, and the land base is the source of all life, and without a healthy land base, if you're destroying your land base, you're destroying yourselves ultimately. And so, yeah, I'm an environmentalist. I am an old school Earth Firster. I'm not an Earth Firster now because the organization has become such a complete mess.
Yeah.
But original Earth First, where all it is the Earth is first, you betcha.
Okay, so you are Derek Jensen, are you a doomer?
Define doomer, please.
A doomer is, in my opinion, just someone who believes, based on reading mountains of evidence, that there's no turning this freight train around and this civilization and probably the vast majority of our fellow Earthlings are going down with the ship. Is that open-ended enough?
Yeah, so I agree with most of those things. I agree that civilization is not and has never been sustainable. It can never be sustainable. I believe that it is going to come down reasonably soon. I believe that every day that passes, it is destroying more of the world. And I believe that that given especially people's insanity, collective insanity, that there is no turning around this freight train of destruction, as you may have put it. I agree with all of that. I agree that things are going to get increasingly chaotic and increasingly nasty for first world humans. And I put that first world in because we're going to come back to it in a second. The hesitation I have in using the word doomer is that I think from the perspective of redwood trees and from the perspective of coho salmon and from the perspective of blue whales, the collapse of civilization, the stopping of the industrial economy, let's say, will be a cause for rejoicing. And since my primary loyalty is there, it's like, yeah, it's going to – I mean, I will die through this process. There's absolutely no doubt. I have multiple diseases that require high-tech medicines. And the thing is, my life is less important than the health of the land base. And I'm not just saying that abstractly. It's just – I feel this in every cell in my body. And every person who's ever lived dies. And that's the thing. And what remains? And again, I've been thinking about this a lot because of the death of my mom. What remains? And one of the things that remains, okay, so I read this interesting book a year ago, and I'm going to come back to more of the doomer stuff in a second. I read a really interesting book a year and a half ago, or 2 years ago, called 13 Moons by Charles Frazier. He wrote Cold Mountain, which was really a big deal.
Yeah.
Anyway, 13 Moons is about a guy who lives in North Carolina. It's set from 1820 to 1900. And it's primarily a love story, which was not my favorite part of the book. Love story between a man and a woman. But the thing I did love was that there was also a love story between the man and the land. And he moved there, or he was there in 1820, just after the buffalo had gotten kicked out, when there were still wolves there. And by 1900, he is living next to a railroad that is, as he says, taking tourists west every day and taking forests east every evening. And he has this great point in there that as you grow old, the guy at the end, he's 85 or something, and all of his friends have died, and his lovers have died, and everyone has died. And he says, you know, that's what's supposed to happen, that we live, we lose our friends, all of that dies, and we evolved in that process. Every creature who's ever lived has that happen. But what hasn't happened is, and what we aren't used to, what we didn't evolve with, is losing a land base such that it used to be that one tree would fall in the forest and more trees would come up. But you wouldn't be born into a forest and through your lifetime see that forest destroyed. And it was an absolutely beautiful discussion of that. And so from that perspective, yes, we all die, but what's not supposed to die is the land. And from that perspective, I don't consider the collapse of civilization doom. I consider that the best thing that can happen. And then when I said first world humans, I want to say two things real quick. One of them is, years ago, I asked Anuradha Mittal, former director of Food First, if the people of India would be better off if the global economy disappeared tomorrow. And she laughed and said, of course. And said, there are former granaries of India that now export dog food and tulips to Europe. And there are former granaries of India that now are dry because the land has been taken for export crops. The water has been taken by Nestle and Coca-Cola. And so the people were living there doing subsistence farming for thousands of years. And they want to do that, but they're getting kicked off the land. And then about 10 years ago, or no, it was 5 or 6 years ago, excuse me, I had the opportunity to ask Vandana Shiva, what about the people who live in Mumbai? What about the people in the slums? What will happen to them when civilization collapses? And she said, do you think they're living in the slums because they want to? They're living in the slums because they've been forced off their land. And if you get rid of the global economy, they will go right back to the land and they will do what they've been doing for thousands of years. When you really think about it, what is it, one-third or a quarter of the people on the planet don't have electricity? When the grid goes down, they're not going to be harmed. The ones who are being harmed, they're being harmed right now because, again, you know, the land is being taken in Africa for exporting lima beans to Europe. And, yes, this way of life is really, really addictive. It's very addictive to have, as Lewis Mumford talked about, more luxuries than a pharaoh in Egypt. I mean, we have power at our command that they never dreamed of. And that is incredibly addictive. And that's one reason this culture is not going to have a voluntary transformation. But that doesn't alter the fact that from the perspective of blue whales, having TVs is not good. You know, having TVs is costing everybody else on the planet. And this is we seem to think that all of this stuff, it's just extraordinary to me how many people basically, do you know the phrase cargo cult? Have you used that on your show?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, so it's amazing to me how many people think that the planet is, and we are a cargo cult because we expect for the planet to just be keep giving, but don't they understand that everything you have came from somewhere and someone else already lived there?
No, very few people understand that, Derek, as you know.
So anyway, am I a doomer? I guess, except I think that the collapse of civilization, even though it will kill me, I think it can't happen soon enough. So does that make me a doomer? Or does that make me a...
I'm talking more about what I call the deep end of the
happy
doomsday
doomer
prophecy pool. I'm talking about as you mentioned in a recent essay, there's a difference between the ends of previous empires and the end of the current empire. That difference is global ecological collapse. I'm all with you on the civilization, brother. It'll kill me too, and I will gladly take my place. But I'm talking about I'm talking about all of the our fellow Earthlings that you speak for. Are you a doomer when you're speaking for them instead of speaking for your own species?
Okay, what does a doomer mean having to do with them? Are they in trouble? Yes. Can this trouble be alleviated the freight train is rushing forward. If somebody put explosives on the track right in front of the freight train, it would not run over all of those who are more than a half mile down the track. So does the fact that this culture is killing everything and this culture has tremendous momentum make me want to quit? No. It's like a friend of mine says, John Osborne, that the reason he does the work is because as things become increasingly chaotic, he wants to make sure that some doors remain open. You know, I came up not in radical politics, but instead in grassroots environmental activism. And all the activists I know, whether they acknowledge it or not, they were basically hanging on by their fingernails, trying to protect this or that place they love until civilization collapses. Because they recognize that this culture is just going to keep cutting. Yeah. It's just going to keep doing bulldozing. But once it collapses, things can actually start coming back pretty fast. This is why, look at what's happened in the DMZ in Korea. You know, you give that 60 years now, and it's a wildlife haven. Or look at what's happened at Chernobyl. Let's ignore the radiological damage. That's not the point right now. The point right now is that you take off the agriculture, you take off the human beings, and the wolves come back, the moose come back, the beavers come back. Life wants to live.
Both of those are human exclusion zones. That's what they have in common.
Yes. And there are more than 450 dead zones. This research is a few years old, so it's probably like 900 dead zones now. Something like 450 dead zones in the ocean. Only one of them that I know of is recovered, and it's in the Black Sea. And the reason it recovered is because when the Soviet Union collapsed, they were no longer able to do industrial agriculture on shore just next to the place where this dead zone was. And in 20 years, so 1990, by 10 years ago, the place had recovered enough that they had a commercial fishery there. I don't think commercial fishery is okay. But the point is that the fish came back. You know, the image I keep thinking of all the time is that you have an emergency room, and you have this this patient who is on a gurney, and you have all these doctors and nurses who are there trying to put bandages on to stop all the bleeding because the person is bleeding all over. Put bandage on here. You give them antibiotics. You're doing all this stuff. But what they're not doing is, as they're doing this, there is a serial killer who is still stabbing the person. It's like the first thing you do is stop the serial killer.
Yeah.
And so, am I a doomer for the rest of the planet? Yes, the rest of the planet is doomed. Oh, my friend, by the way, I started the story and didn't finish it. My friend says, as things become increasingly chaotic, he wants to make sure that some doors remain open. What he means by that is if bull trout are still around in 10 years, they may still be around in 100. But if they're gone in 10, they're gone forever. So he thinks, I agree, it's just desperately important that we protect every piece of ground, as well as taking offensive action to stop this culture, as we would do if it was space aliens who'd come down and were doing this, as well as taking offensive action. We need to protect every species, every scrap of ground. We need to fight like hell and just hold on desperately until the whole system really crumbles. And we have the opportunity, I think. I mean, I don't think it's going to last that much longer, by which I don't mean 2 years, but certainly, I mean, I think it's possible that if I were to live till the end of my natural life, I would see the end of civilization, however we mark that, which is an interesting question, too. How do you mark it? I think we would see that within How old are you?
I am 1 year older than you are.
Okay, so I think if you live a natural life, I think there's a chance we would see whatever it is. I think we will see the global economy begin to contract, which is good for the planet. Because what the global economy is, what GNP is a measure of how quickly the living planet is converted into dead objects to be sold.
Okay, well, I want to get back to the human exclusion zones, and I want to... you wrote in a recent essay, recently more and more people are talking about the possibility of human extinction. That possibility has entered our consciousness enough that the New York Times published an op-ed asking whether it would be better for the Earth if humans went extinct. And then you dropped it. Derek, you did not weigh in. So right now, Derek Jensen, would the Earth be better off if humans went extinct?
So before I answer that question, okay, I want to say where I did go, the point I was making with that is that in the mainstream culture, we can, even the New York Times, we can talk about whether it would be better for humans to go extinct, but what we cannot talk about, is the notion of bringing down civilization. That civilization, this system of beliefs and this worship of the machine, frankly, is more important to us than the continuation of human life. That was the point I was making.
That was a point well taken.
Okay, so having said that, I can say with absolutely no hesitation that the Earth would be better off without industrial humans.
Industrial humans. So you are putting an asterisk. You're putting a qualifier before the word all humans.
Yeah, because honestly, the Talua, where I live now, they lived here for 12,500 years at least, and they didn't destroy the place. And it is possible for humans to live a long time in place without destroying it. I mean, if you're going to live someplace 12,500 years and not destroy it, that's good enough for me for sustainability. And that doesn't alter the fact that when you introduce modern technology destroys those traditional cultures in that there are people who were living sustainably who now have their tribal councils vote to support oil drilling or golf courses or, you know, whatever other destructive activities. And that's part of the addictiveness of what Jack Forbes would have called the Wedigo disease, the cannibal sickness that is consuming the planet. So I don't want to say, I don't believe that humans are inherently destructive. I think that humans who have adopted this an industrial human supremacist perspective are inherently destructive, and the world would be better off. And also, there's another story I want to tell here, which is, you know, when I was a kid, my mom would tell I'm still messy. When I was a kid, my mom would tell me to clean my room, and I wouldn't do it. She would tell me to clean the room, and I wouldn't do it. Just go on and on and on. And finally, she would say to me, "Look, excuse me. You're going to clean the room before dinner, because if you don't, I'm going to clean it up. And if I clean it up, you're not going to like it because I'm going to throw everything away." And that is how I believe that's what's going to happen, is that we can either attempt to clean this up ourselves and save whatever is precious to us, or the natural world's going to clean it up and it's not going to make fine distinctions. It's going to throw all of us away. And you know, it's extraordinary to me that I am considered misanthropic, which I may very well be. But the thing that gets me is that why would I be considered misanthropic when you have people who are contemplating human extinction because they won't contemplate the end of civilization? Why aren't they misanthropic? Because at least my option, allows for some humans to continue.
Leaves a few of us around. Where do you weigh in on the whole NTHE thing? I haven't seen you. I'm sure you've addressed it somewhere. Do you, on any level, are you in the camp that we're going to be extinct by the year 2030?
No. No, I don't think so. I think that the economic system could be well into collapse by then, but it could be. I don't know. See, I'm very uncomfortable with the notion of putting deadlines on any of this. And I learned my lesson from something that happened in, oh gosh, was it the 70s? Paul Ehrlich made a famous bet with
Julian Simon, yeah.
Yeah, when was that? Was that the 70s, 80s?
I think that, I'm not sure when the actual year of the bet was, but Paul was a little reckless on that bet.
Well, that's the thing. Paul Ehrlich has done wonderful work. I'm saying nothing bad about him, but that, I think, was a tactical error. And for the listeners who don't know it, it's he made a bet with Julian Simon, was it?
Yeah.
Saying that the price... Basically saying
three things, and I think he missed all three of them that were, yeah, they all went down instead of up because we ramped up the mining.
Yeah, and the point is that, you know, he's right eventually, you know, in the long term, but I think it's not a good idea to say that, to put specific deadlines on all of that, because, I mean, hell, I can't even predict who's going to win a football game, much less, you know, what's going to happen on a larger scale.
But you are on record for saying you believe that a whole lot of humans are going to die over it as this collapse.
Well, we're an overshoot, and we have this. This is. I'm not saying when, and I don't know. I don't know when, but. This culture has long since exceeded carrying capacity. And what happens to everybody who exceeds carrying capacity is you have a crash. This is what happens. And I'm frankly surprised it hasn't happened already.
I'm shocked. Every day I'm shocked. So you do see a crash, but you see some of us coming out of the other end of the bottleneck.
Well, part of the reason I wouldn't want to say human extinction by 2030 is there's an awful lot of us, and even if you had some sort of pandemic, there's going to be a few people hanging on somewhere, quite a few people. You could talk about we might have a discussion about whether there will still be air travel in 2030. Yeah. You know, I don't know. I would be just making things up if I said anything. But, I mean, if some pandemic spread across the world right now that was 99% fatal, which I don't know of any pandemics that are 99% fatal to humans, but if it were, if that's one person out of 100, is 10 people out of 1,000, 100 people out of 10,000. Well, if you've got 10,000 people out of 1,000,000, so it's 10 million out of 1,000,000,000. And I don't know what the population is now. If it's, what,
it's
8 billion, 7
billion?
Let's
call it 8. Yeah, I know what you mean. Yeah, even in 99%.
The point is, there's still 700 million people survived the 99%.
Yeah.
Pandemic. So it's like, that's why it's, I can see us on our way to extinction, but there's no way. There's too many of us to all go that fast, unless it's a meteor or something. I don't know. I could be wrong. Like I said, I can't even predict a football game. I can't predict anything. And I enjoy trying to predict football games, but I'm terrible at it.
Okay, we are, I hate to say it, we are, good Lord, 54 minutes. We are 6 minutes away from the collapse of global industrial civilization here on
the
kitchen table. So, I still got about 8 more things written down here.
Well, let's do it again.
How do we roll up our sleeves and bring this down? You're saying it's time for us to roll up our sleeves. I'm ready to roll up my sleeves, Derek Jensen. And how do I do that?
Well, a few things. One is the things that are easy and legal are just protect wild places and wild beings. That's not going to bring things down, but anything you can do to help wild nature is great. Now, so far as actually bringing it down, so many indigenous people have said to me that the first and most important thing we have to do is to decolonize our hearts and minds. And one of the things that means to me is to recognize, to make our loyalty with the natural world and not with the industrial economic system. And once you've done that, there are still plenty of ways forward. One can attempt to do propaganda, as I do with my work, as you do with yours. One can do regular defense work. One can, you know, trying to protect pieces of land, doing timber sale appeals, whatever. One can also do restoration work. One can make it possible for prairie dogs or beavers to do that restoration work, or wolves. That's all really important. And then if we want to, I'm sort of dancing around. Now we're going to circle around to get to the center of how we bring it down. Is one of the most important things is to, this is the way I look at it, is to, if space aliens had come down and they had instituted a government of occupation and they were doing to the planet what the dominant culture is doing to the planet, I think we would then be able to have intelligent discussions about how we resist and what we do. And what we would do is we would start asking ourselves, we would recognize that a war is being fought, and we would say, how do you win wars? And we would read history, and we would learn that generally the way you win wars is by destroying the enemy's capacity to wage war. And we can talk all we want about the Battle of Gettysburg and the Battle of Vicksburg, and both of those, yes, were very, very important, especially the Battle of Vicksburg because it cut off the West. But the reason, one of the big reasons that the wars are not usually won on battlefields. Wars are usually won in the industrial workplace. And the North was able to destroy the South's capacity to wage war. In Germany, in World War II, how did the Allies win? Well, we do have the Soviets, you know, just grinding the German army to nothing on the Eastern Front. Absolutely. And then the other thing that was really important was the Allied bombing campaign. So the question becomes, how do you destroy the dominant culture's ability to wage war on the natural world? Well, I think it's really important, before we talk about strategy and tactics, it's really important for people to recognize, first, that there's a war going on. Second, to start thinking like members of a resistance. If you were in France in World War II, what would you do to harm the German war effort? If you were going to be dropped down in occupied Czechoslovakia at the time, what would you do to harm the? And then another thing that's really important is I love what Kathleen Dean Moore says, because people will say to her all the time, what can one person do? And she always says, don't be one person. And what she means by that is organize, organize, organize. And this is something, there is much that I love about the Doomer community. And there's something, I'm not talking about you, because I don't even know you on this level, but a part of the Doomer community and part of the hesitation I have to claim that title is that so many of them go, gosh, you know, I need to learn how to grieve the loss of the natural world. I need to learn how to grieve all that, and I need to handle my grief. It's like, you know what? I'm more in the Joe Hill attitude, which is don't mourn, organize.
Okay, well, I'm hoping I can figure out how to tack on the end of this, because we're getting ready to collapse here, but let's hope I figure out how to get around this. So Derek Jensen, if you were not talking to Sam Mitchell at Collapse Chronicles, where you had a full hour to talk, but you actually had the mainstream media sticking a microphone in front of your face to ask you the question, Derek Jensen, give us your 60-second soundbite You're the Derek Jensen message to planet Earth here in late 2019. What would that 60-second soundbite sound like?
This way of life will not last forever. When it's over, I would prefer that there is more left of the living planet than less.
Okay, well, you did that. You did that in 12 seconds. And, and again, I don't know if I'm enough of a. Hopefully, one of my techies can figure out how to tack that on. But there is still a bunch of stuff that we need to talk about. I really wanted to get into the whole. I guess you're writing a new book, Bright Green Lies.
Yeah, that book is done. It's out of publisher. We're trying to find a publisher for it.
Okay, so let's make this deal, because that'll be a whole new, an entire conversation. So when that does happen in your life, definitely keep me in the loop, and we will talk again about the difference between deep green and bright green and mainstream environmentalism and radical environmentalism, and I'm sure we'll have no trouble filling up another hour. But for this interview, brother, I am so glad we finally got the chance to talk, and we really appreciate you coming on here and spending an hour of your time with us here on Collapse Chronicles. And more importantly, we really, Derek Jensen, we really do appreciate your lifetime of hard work for a sometimes thankless task. And keep up the good fight.
Well, you too. Thank you so much. Your questions were great, and some of which I had never had before.
All right. Well, stick around for just a minute. Let me shut this down, and then we'll wrap this up.
Okay.
Anyway, guys, it's been fun, and we will have Derek back on the show when his new book, Bright Green Lies, comes out sometime soon. For now, bye, guys.